Welcome to Soundprint. I'm Barbara Bogave. Today I went to work, shopped for groceries, attended a town meeting, cooked dinner, and made history. You did too, at least that last bit. Every day, we all make history. As someone once said, history is the essence of innumerable biographies. Of course, we don't usually think about this as we lumber through our daily lives. It takes a natural catastrophe, a national crisis, a war, something like that, to wake us up to the fact that we live history day by day. And this is the way it goes even in times of great social upheaval, like the 60s. Our show today is a good example of this. 40 years ago, in 1963, Martin Luther King led the March on Washington for jobs and freedom. 1963 became a historic marker. It would later be dubbed the Year of Decision by the Civil Rights Movement. Also in 1963, Soundprint producer Askia Muhammad and his two friends were living in Los Angeles. They were all very busy. They were studying, working, running track, or running with a gang, but they hadn't yet discovered radical politics, or politics of any kind. They were young black men whose lives would eventually be deeply marked by the struggle for civil rights. But according to Askia, in 1963, they were sleeping through the dream.
My mother, Nola Mae Canterbury, had a great sense of humor. She was also a strict and frugal single mom. I thought she could hold on to a dollar bill until she made the eagle grin. "Mother," I pleaded with her in 1963, after Cousin Titus moved out of a room in our house in Los Angeles. He had been her tenant for years. His room had an outside entrance, its own bathroom and kitchen, and I wanted to turn it into a photography studio and darkroom. "This is a foolproof idea," I told her. Well, she deadpanned, "You're just the fool to prove it."
Our day will come, and we'll have everything.
I could rent the room, she relented, but I would have to pay the same $8 a week Cousin Titus had been paying, no discount. And as collateral, she would keep the used Rolleiflex camera I had just purchased, except when I had a portrait or a wedding to photograph. I wasn't Mama Nola's little boy anymore. I had quit her Providence Missionary Baptist Church and started going to the very fundamentalist Figueroa Church of Christ with my high school buddy, Clint Wilson. In August 1963, America was learning about Martin Luther King Jr.'s dream. Meanwhile, Clint Wilson had an ex-high school friend named Charles. That was me. I called myself C.K. Moreland Jr., photographer extraordinaire. I was all Southern California all the time, and Southern California was about being cool, not about civil rights.
There's just sort of a culture in L.A., and I'm talking now about, you know, black people in L.A., of being sort of removed from the real world. And while I was never personally caught up in that, I think that it had a lot to do with, there was sort of a fool's goal out there, but there was kind of feeling that the issues that were important in Birmingham or Selma or whatever was in another world, that we in Los Angeles didn't really have those same concerns in that way.
Clint was a year ahead of me at John C. Fremont High School. In addition to church and the Navy, Clint and I were bound by our participation in a journalism program called the Scholastic Sports Association. Clint took that experience and became a journalism major at Cal State Los Angeles. Years later, he recalled to a group of students how his eyes were opened to racism.
And so my barber, who also happened to have been a deacon at my church, says, "Well, young Wilson here represents the key to the future. You know, he's in college, and things are just going to be better, you know, for him. I mean, we're making progress as a race." And so one of the men who was in the shop who was waiting for a haircut, he says, "Oh," I said, "well, that's quite impressive." He says, "Young Wilson, what's your major?" And so I said, "Well, I'm a journalism major." And he immediately scoffed and started, "I thought you were intelligent. You know, we can't do that. They don't allow us to do that. Why aren't you doing something meaningful with your college education?"
My recollection of that, Askia, was that we graduated in June of 1962, Valarian class.
Richard Stebbins also attended Fremont. He and I were in the same graduating class. His coming of age came more abruptly.
I went away, and eventually I transferred down to Grambling in Louisiana, which put me in touch January of 63 put me in touch with the movement per se. But I was in the rural South. When I came home that summer, no one seemed to be aware of how strong the movement was in terms of overt racism as it related down South. It was very clear down South. There were marches every week. There were protests and so forth. But as far as the movement, we were, if you had stayed in California, specifically L.A., you were oblivious.
Richard, he was a different animal. Where Clinton and I mostly wrote about our school's great athletes, Richard was a great athlete. Richard was smart, but he also had the ultimate social connection. He was a well-respected gang member. He was once known as Sleepy from Slauson Village. The Slausons were one of the largest and most feared gangs in South Central Los Angeles in the 1950s and 1960s. Richard was what's now called an OG, an original gangster. Once, he even helped Baby Brother, another high school friend who had killed two people before he was 17, to avoid a murder conviction by intimidating a witness into believing Baby Brother's innocence.
I had to leave the neighborhood because I had gotten in some trouble with the authorities. And I realized that if I stayed, that my social direction was going to not allow me to succeed. I came back for track season in my junior year.
By the time Richard started attending Fremont, Clint was getting ready to graduate and go to Navy boot camp. Richard was just realizing his life's calling then, track and field. Looking back, though the civil rights movement may not have yet reached us, we all agree on the positive influence of caring teachers in our lives.
Those people there basically mentored us.
They cared.
They cared. And I can remember distinctly your Hollywood Jack, my Dorothy Tompkins, and I'm sure any other individual who created the path for himself had someone along the way that directed them. Richard Adams was my junior high PE teacher, and Dorothy Tompkins, they were like, you know, they were like mom and dad. Richard Adams was an old Marine, military, straight, you know, regimented guy, and Dorothy Tompkins was an old Rodgers and Hammerstein loving German European woman who loved music. But she also really stressed that you need to travel. You need to see the world. And that's what I found when I came back to L.A. that summer of King, was that I had moved. And I was conscious of certain things. But when I talked socially, all one could say was that maybe Smokey was coming to the Hollywood Palladium July 23rd.
While Richard was making his way through the gangs of L.A. and the movement in the South, my friend Clint was connecting into an entirely different network where he remembers meeting Martin Luther King Jr. in person.
I met him when I was pledging. This goes back to 1962. At L.A. City College, and you may recall, they had this lecture, the annual lecture, and they'd invite, while I was there, they had Eleanor Roosevelt, I remember Bertrand Russell. Anyway, Martin Luther King was one of these Snyder Lecture Series speakers, and I had written the advanced story on him coming to campus to speak, and it was a lead story in the newspaper. So the president of the college, L.A. City College, invited myself and the student body president and a few other student luminaries to have lunch with Dr. King after the speech over in a little private dining room they had. And so it was there that I was all in awe, of course, of him. And I just happened to mention that I was pledge and for the fraternity. You know, given the atmosphere of those times, I was scared to death because I'm thinking at any moment he's going to pull a paddle out or something and strike me or something. But he was just very encouraged. Oh, that's wonderful. And he, you know, asked me about my major and those kinds of things and put me very much at ease.
Led by Dr. King and others, blacks in the South were engaged in a life and death struggle, which would be a gigantic catalyst for transforming American public policy. But me, I was sleeping through that dream. I was an inner city kid, more concerned about the black folks in Detroit who were shaping American culture than I was about public anything. I remember the 1963 Martha and the Vandellas hit Heat Wave more than I remember nonviolent civil disobedience. The year of decision, as 1963 became for the civil rights movement and the nation at large, saw the first long hot summer. The Southern Christian Leadership Conference decided to engage in civil disobedience. SCLC defied a judge's injunction when they marched to Birmingham on May 7th. A stunned nationwide television audience watched as Police Chief Eugene Bull Connor ordered his officers to use trained dogs and high-pressure fire hoses to disperse the peaceful marchers. Angry Negroes retaliated, torching white businesses, slashing the tires of police cars. The SCLC leadership decided to take its campaign out of the churches and into the pool halls, where some of the young hotheads who were not committed to its nonviolent ideals often congregated. SCLC's the Reverend Ralph Abernathy was presented to the pool hall crowd by Bernard Lee.
And he will speak to you at this time, Reverend Ralph Abernathy.
Thank you very kindly, Mr. Lee. First thing I want to say is that we are involved in a struggle for freedom. Yes. And we don't want anybody to get the impression that we are cowards, because we don't need any cowards in our band. We intend to march on and to struggle on until freedom is won.
Amen.
We are not going to New York City to find freedom. We are not going to Los Angeles, California to find freedom, but we are determined to find freedom right here in Birmingham, Alabama. Now, we know that the time has come for that freedom. But Governor Wallace is not our leader.
Right.
Bull Connor is not our leader.
Right.
In every movement, you must have a leader. Is that right? Now, do you know who our leader is?
Yes.
God sent Martin Luther King to lead us.
Like the angry hotheads in Birmingham, Richard recalls that fighting back, defending your turf, not turning the other cheek, was the philosophy we knew in South Central Los Angeles.
Some students in my freshman year went on a march, and they wanted to integrate Rustin's drugstore or something. And about 10 of them came back beaten bloody. And I wasn't a disciple of nonviolence. King's tactics in this part of the world were met with stiff, obvious resistance and physical violence, as well as verbal abuse. Well, coming from L.A., I couldn't turn the other cheek. That wasn't part of my makeup at that time. I understood the power of nonviolence. I understood the power of Gandhi. But we were from South Central, where neighborhood rivalries and fights were, you know, to make your mark. You know, as a young man, you had to defend yourself.
Thousands of blacks were eventually arrested, including 200 children as young as 7. Dr. King was placed in isolation. In the months following the Birmingham campaign, 800 civil rights demonstrations took place in cities and towns of the South and the North. White clergy and citizens of all faiths increasingly joined the civil rights campaign. Birmingham, Dr. King wrote later, was a fuse. It detonated a revolution that went on to win scores of other victories. Labor leader A. Philip Randolph, the dean of the Negro leadership, then proposed a gigantic march on Washington to dramatize the demand for equality. And on August 28, 1963, the march stretched from the Washington Monument to the steps of the Lincoln Memorial. The symbolism was powerful. How could America say no to the demand for equal rights in the 100th year since the Emancipation Proclamation, coming from the descendants of slaves as they stood on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial? By the force of the demands put forth, by the determination of the marchers, and by their sheer numbers, march organizer John Lewis said that day, we have and will continue to splinter segregation into 1,000 pieces and put them back together in the image of God and democracy.
You can read a storybook. You can turn from page to page.
Back in Los Angeles, however, I don't even remember hearing or reading about the march. But Clint, at least, has a clear recollection of news reports about it.
I remember vividly that the edition of the Los Angeles Sentinel, immediately following the March on Washington, had obviously a main headline and talked about King and his speech. And then there was another article on the same page noting that W.E.B. Du Bois had died. And I did not know who he was. I read that article and said, this guy is significant, you know. Why don't I know about him? And, you know, I'm college educated. He was also a member of the fraternity. That struck me again that Los Angeles was out of place. That had I gone to school at Howard or Texas Southern or Grambling or someplace, that I would have known before that point who he was.
Clint and I both studied journalism at L.A. City College and at Cal State Los Angeles. Clint maintained his academic focus, however, eventually earning a doctorate at the University of Southern California as I was flailing around from school to school. We grew apart. He was in his element among the brothers of Alpha Phi Alpha fraternity, the oldest and most elite Black Greek letter society in the country. I had fallen in among the gamblers and petty hustlers. Harvard-trained scholar Dr. W.E.B. Du Bois was one of the fraternity's early members. Two other prominent members were athlete, lawyer, actor, and singer Paul Robeson and Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr.
It's interesting because I saw two levels of recognition for him, and it reflected what we were talking about earlier in terms of the spectrum of thought in the Black community. He had such a major national presence that you can't help in a public way to express pride and so forth in him and what he was doing. But yet, I knew that there were members of the fraternity who thought he was rocking the boat, going too far. And I would add that I saw the same sense with Paul Robeson, that there was this kind of two levels of appreciation that you know, a pride that he was an alpha and all that. But, some thought, well, he may have been, I think he had communist leanings, or to be a communist in those days was not to be admired. Again, I learned from that, no matter what you do, what your accomplishments are, there are going to be those who will be detractors, you know. It just would seem to me that we would wholeheartedly be behind anybody who's trying to address these issues. But some people, I might even say in a setting with white folks, they might be embarrassed or not even mention that this person was a member of the fraternity.
Richard was at Grambling in 1963. That summer would be a turning point for him. Track and field had become the main focus of his life, but it was a tragedy that year which helped him learn how he could soar even higher.
Death of my mentor, his name was Eugene Allen. Eugene Allen died in 1963 in May, and Eugene Allen had bet money for 2 years on me every Friday when we'd have a track meet. And every Friday night he'd come by and give me maybe $25 or $30, and I didn't know where he got the money from. And he said, I'm going to tell you something. He said, all of us have to do this life, in other words, street life and gang stuff. He said, you don't have to do that. He said, if you apply yourself, you have something that we don't. He said, we have to do that. He said, you got a gift. I think you can do anything. And then he got killed that summer of 63. He got killed trying to rob a liquor store. And when I got home, I was overcome with grief, and I realized at that time that this was not the way, and I'm going to go back to Louisiana and apply myself and use my mind and use my skills. And I got very serious about academics and knowledge. I got very serious about athletics. As a 19-year-old young man, I gave up sex. I became abstinent. And my friends, my roommates told me, they said, man, we think he's crazy. We think he's out of his mind.
Whoa.
Richard threw himself wholeheartedly into his studies after that. He literally ate and slept track and field. He and his teammates on Grambling's NCAA championship relay team practiced baton passes everywhere they went, including to and from the cafeteria. In fact, it was Richard's proficiency at baton passing with either hand and his ability to get along with temperamental sprinter Bob Hayes, a sprinter he could never outrun even in practice, which landed him the slot running the third leg on the 1964 U.S. Olympic 4x100 relay team. The U.S. team, with Richard Stebbins handing off to anchorman Bob Hayes, won the gold medal at the Tokyo Games and set a new Olympic record in the process.
The biggest problem one has is with oneself. It's not the competition. If you do what you're capable of doing 9 out of 10 times, you're going to win. I look at you and I see that because I knew you as Charles Moreland. One has to harness what they are within themselves, and that's what I did. And in teaching kids today, discipline, regimentation, having a goal, and being willing to do what's necessary to reach that goal. A lot of us talk. Very rarely do we follow up.
As for me, it took a little longer before I woke up. Though I slept right through the civil rights dream in 1963, when the civil rights movement was finally born on the West Coast in the form of the Watts Riot in 1965, and the next year with the founding of the Black Panther Party in Oakland, my life, too, took a turn that would lead me eventually to a journalism career, reporting from the White House, first for the Chicago Daily Defender, and now for National Scene News Bureau and The Final Call. Be what I wanna be. Clint, Richard, and I traveled long separate ways from the time of the original March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom to reunite in Washington more than a decade ago. Dr. Clint Wilson is now a professor of journalism at Howard University School of Communications. Richard Stebbins escaped unscarred from L.A. gang life with more than just an Olympic gold medal from Tokyo. Now he's a middle school teacher in Prince George's County, Maryland. He graduated cum laude from Grambling University, and he earned a master's degree from Howard University. There is a place in Washington, D.C., which is literally hallowed ground in America's struggle to reconcile its centuries-old racial conflict. It's hard not to be awed. Here at the memorial to President Abraham Lincoln, the great emancipator, Contralto Marian Anderson, the first black woman to star in the Metropolitan Opera, sang a concert when the all-white Daughters of the American Revolution refused to permit her to sing at Constitution Hall, just 6 blocks away. And right here, 18 steps from the top of the marble chamber at this spot now marked by a 24-inch by 10-inch inscription which reads, "I Have a Dream, Martin Luther King Jr., the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom, August 28, 1963, history was recorded once again. And now, 40 years later, people from all over still come here speaking in a variety of voices. Where are you from?
I'm from Korea.
I'm from Spain.
Israel.
We're from Virginia.
Ashburn, Virginia.
Sterling.
Yeah, Potomac Falls.
I am from a small town called Hickory Ridge, Arkansas.
We are here on vacation from Tennessee and wanted to show our kids some of the memories that I had coming to see these important pieces of American history.
I'm from Iowa. I don't remember all the words to it. It's really, really in my heart as opposed to the words coming to memory.
Yeah, well, I know that story and I know Martin Luther King. I think that is really important.
And I know the basic ideas of the speech, the conception. Freedom, same rights for whoever lives in this country, which should be the same for the whole world. We're all human beings. At the end of the day, we're all happy from the same things. We are sad from the same things. You know, so that's what I say.
That's my birthday. The day that he did that speech was my birthday, August 28th. I have a dream that all women and children, colors, will be equal. That's all I know. And it's something like, I have a dream that people will not be judged by the color of their skin,
but the content,
of their character.
How old are you all?
I'm 13.
Dr. King wrote soon after the march, "As television beamed the image of this extraordinary gathering across the border oceans, everyone who believed in man's capacity to better himself had a moment of inspiration and confidence in the future of the human race." At the end of 1963, Time magazine named Dr. King its Man of the Year. Soon after, he was awarded the 1964 Nobel Peace Prize. And the crowning achievement of the 1963 civil rights marches and demonstrations was passage by Congress and signature into law by President Lyndon Johnson of the landmark Civil Rights Act of 1964. Young girl, she grew up in a rush. Every man she... In 1982, while she was visiting me from California, I took my daughter Nadira, then just 9 years old, on a pilgrimage to that place because I wanted to send through her a message to the future about the sacrifices and the courage, about committed lives ultimately redeemed, as Dr. King often said, by undeserved suffering. I wanted her to see the place so that each time she now takes students from her 12th grade civics classes, and when she takes her yet unborn children to that sacred and monumental place, she will also see the lightning flash. She will hear the thunder roar.
Sleeping Through the Dream was produced by Askia Mohammed. Production assistance by Anuya Dove. The sound engineer was Matt McCleskey. The show was mixed by Jared Weisbrot. Special thanks to Pacifica Radio Archives. Askia Mohammed has been making documentaries for Soundprint for over a decade. You can hear his other programs when you visit us online at soundprint.org. Soundprint's internet service is provided by ToadNet, internet connectivity for people like you. More information at www.toad.net. We love it when you write. Recently, I have been taken to task for carelessly using the phrase Cold War paranoia when it didn't apply, and I want to thank you for that, Storm Russell. Please send your gentle chidings, your questions, or your comments for us to talkback@soundprint.org. That's talkback@soundprint.org. CDs of Soundprint cost $12.50. To order, call us toll-free at 1-888-38-TAPES. That's 1-888-38-TAPES. Soundprint is produced by the Soundprint Media Center in association with WAMU and American University. Soundprint is Technical Director Anna Maria DeFreitas, Associate Producer Katie Gott, Production Assistant Anuya Dove, and Sound Engineer Jared Weisbrot. Our Executive Producer is Moira Rankin. I'm Barbara Bogave.